I do have handouts from my remarks and a bibliography for students in Rio cyberspace. That's a frequently asked question sheet. So if I go too fast, the information is at least available. I'm thankful to be here today, although I have the unenviable task of following three such esteemed speakers. I, as a pastor, will confess to you, I will not be as humorous as our chairman, nor as succinct and insightful as Dr. Sickinga, and not as comprehensive and well-read as Dr. West. It's a privilege to be with you. I note that Michael Behe will be speaking in the morning, and I'm sure he will speak about evolution, and I would like to speak a little bit about evolution, not the kind of macroevolution that he and others are disputing in these days, but a microevolution, a very small kind of evolution or development, like the kind of development that is supported by good science, and unlike the kind of evolution that is neither supported by good science or metaphysics, the development of a particular political idea appears in a specific religious incubator. Contrary to much secular thought, I want to assert that the true origin of a social contract that guarantees human liberties lies in the seedbed of the Reformation. Another social contract, a humanist one, did have its cradle in the secular thinking of the Enlightenment. The one I'll call the social covenant, to distinguish, has resisted tyranny, totalitarianism, and authoritarianism with consistent and irrepressible force. The other has led to oppression, large-scale loss of life, and the general diminution of liberty, economic and personal. Others, of course, have drawn the contrast between Reformation and Revolution thought, chiefly Burke, Lamennais, Haller, and Grenville Prinstrup. The American Founding Fathers, I believe it can be shown, drew predominantly on the Reformation's social covenant model rather than imbibing from the well of a revolutionary social contract. I would like to review with you, or acquaint you if you're not familiar, with five peak performances of the Reformation era. And what I will do is briefly summarize and introduce five leading tracks from the period of political thought that had enduring impact on our society. And those are as follows. The Right of Magistrates by Theodore Beza, John Calvin's disciple, in 1574. The Rights of the Crown of Scotland by George Buchanan. No relationship, I'm told I should inform you, to Pat, that we know of, although that might bear investigation. The Vindicia Contra Tyrannis Politica by Johannes Althusius and Lex Rex by Samuel Rutherford. Along with the binge of tracts immediately adjacent to the Reformation in the years 1550 to 1580, and these five that I will share with you, there seems to be an organic and undeniable connection that shows a unique basis of thought, indeed a Kuhnian paradigm, if you will, in its own right. Indeed, no other philosophical worldview precisely accounts for the ideas that we see around us that our other colleagues have mentioned. And yet, I think it's important to note these ideas did not develop ex nihilo. They had a few noticeable points before which they were rarely in existence. Further, they also had definite points after which they had achieved massive society-wide acceptance. In many cases, these ideas did develop slowly and in seed form. They evolved over time, but they did so in a particular petri dish, to keep the scientific metaphor, or perhaps since so many were Scottish, maybe we should say in a particular cloning lab. I would like to propose two theses. First, that ideas do evolve incrementally out of past context. In the words of that great Jewish philosopher Solomon, there is nothing new under the sun. And if that is true, then all political ideas have precursors, and political advances grow out of specific intellectual soils. For our discussion, this means that some of the best ideas associated with democracy are not really the property of those democracies. Instead, democracies came as after effects and were the beneficiaries of these good ideas. I will seek to show that the evolution of resistance against monopolism has its root uniquely in the Reformation thought. Of course, I do admit there were these seedling precursors before that, but the quantum leaps of development in the 16th century were so large, so monumental, as to deserve notice as a signal and unique contribution. The second thesis I have is that the Reformation evolution of social covenant was first manifested writ large in and is the origin of our own republic. rather than a humanistic version of social contract, as the political glue of our society, it is more accurately the case that a decidedly religious, transcendent platform lies at the base of American society, despite the massive secularist mythos to the contrary. I have on my outline 6 key turning points in the development of good government. I will not develop the first 3, but only mention them for completeness' sake. The first of those was the Hebrew contribution to republicanism, based in the 18th chapter of the book of Exodus. And it is interesting in my study to see that nearly all of the Reformation and post-Reformation political theologians, Calvin, of course, Beza, Bucer, Knox, Buchanan, and Poney among them, draw heavily and devote extensive commentary to this Old Testament contribution of republicanism. The second turning point that Stan Evans and others have documented so well is the religious background, the orthodox medieval theology that was behind and reflected in the Magna Carta, among other documents. The third turning point that I like to mention is a development that misses many radar screens, the conciliar movement among the Roman Catholic clergy in the 15th century. There was a gathering of councils, chief among them being the Council of Constance, that introduced a rather radical notion in the time, and that is that the ruled would sit down with the ruler. And although we take that all for granted, it seemed to be rather radical for its time. Now, let me turn my attention to the magisterial reformers themselves in the first part of the 16th century. John Calvin, of course, is well known for his contribution to civic liberty, and he is known for his immense political impact, but there were other reformers as well. Martin Luther, in the year 1520, published a number of tracts that expressed these ideas, not only of limited government, but also of the rigid set limit to absolute power given to the state. A Lutheran scholar, Karl Hohl, conceded to the Reformation respect for being the first of all in modern times to have prepared the way for the freedom of conscience in the state. All further victories with respect to tolerance rest upon this first step. At the beginning of the Reformation era, Protestants at least began to set delimitations to an unqualified submission to the state. Everywhere that Calvinism proceeded, so did its views of putting the government in its proper place. Calvinism placed a solid barrier in the path of the spread of absolutism. Karl Hull, again, claimed that the acceptance of universal human rights into the Constitution was, however, not just the modification of a singular point. Rather, it included in itself the transformation of the whole concept of the state. Both Luther and his disciple, Philip Melanchthon, allowed resistance to the superior magistrate to be carried out by a lower magistrate. However, it was the second generation of reformers who seem to have most fueled the fires for what became our epistemological foundation for government. And there was a number of seminal works that appeared in rapid succession in one generation. Let me mention some of those because these are so unfamiliar to most of the academy, at least. Martin Bucer's De Regno Christi in 1551 was followed 5 years later by John Poney's A Short Treatise of Political Power. Let me note that we now have all of these posted with a link on our website. They've long been out of print and difficult to find, so you, if you'll get one of the frequently asked question sheets, you can find all of these. Christopher Goodman, who was John Knox's co-pastor while in exile in Geneva, in 1558 published this book with a catchy title, How Superior Powers Ought to Be Obeyed of Their Subjects and Wherein They May Lawfully by God's Word Be Disobeyed and Resisted. Theodore Beza's The Right of the Magistrates was published in 1574, and George Buchanan's The Crown Rights of Scotland in 1579, and Philip Duplessis de Mornay published the Vindicia Contra Tyrannis in 1579. I'd like to spend a few minutes just giving you some highlights. That's all we have time for today of each of those works. Theodore Beza left considerable comment on political matters. Of course, much of his political thought was shaped in no small measure by the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in 1572. Beza's The Right of the Magistrates justified armed resistance led by the intermediating magistrates. His assertion was that the power of the lawful magistrate is neither infinite nor unconditional. If corruption is present, then resistance, according to Beza, may be allowed. Now, he qualified that this overthrow is never to be violent. The rule is steadfast and perpetual, said Beza. His rule was this: on every occasion when we cannot obey the command of men without offending the majesty and despising the authority of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, then we must not participate. As often as the magistrate commands anything that is repugnant either to the worship which we owe unto God or the love which we owe unto our neighbor, we cannot yield obedience thereunto with a safe conscience. Now, much of Beza's thought was further developed in the Vindicia Contra Tyrannis in 1579, probably written by Philip Duplessis Mornay. I say probably written, that's the accepted opinion. I believe it is the correct one. But so close was Beza's thought to this revolutionary document that for centuries, Beza himself was considered to be the author of the Vindicia. I think Harold Lasky and others have shown that it is more likely to be Mornay. Mornay also, in this, or perhaps I should use the pseudonymous name, Junius Brutus, there may have been some wisdom in remaining anonymous in that day, said this: therefore, as the whole people is above the king, and likewise taken in one entire body, yet one by one they are to be under the king. However, this treatise, the Vindicia, put the government in its place, lodging the head of state under the authority of the civil corporation. Vindicia Contra Tyrannis raised and answered the following questions, which I want to read to you because they are so strikingly modern as to sound as if they were taken from either a Whitewater investigation or perhaps asked at a DNC coffee. They are as follows: are kings themselves above the law? May the prince make new laws, or are they made by the people? Does the ruler have power of life and death over his subjects? May the king ignore the law in granting pardon to those found guilty. 1579. Does the property of the people belong to the king? April 15th. Is the king the lawful owner of the kingdom? May the king use the property of the people for his own ends. Now, even by these questions that were radical for their times, this was not an argument that granted absolute sovereignty to the people. Instead of arguing for populism, per se, this powerful tract did not so much explicate an argumentum pro populum as it demonstrated the impossibility of the absolute state. Since God had made a covenant with the king was also to... Citizens were relieved of their obligation of obedience if the ruler damages the covenant. Junius Brutus, the author of the Vindicia, went so far as to advocate that the traditional right of resistance of the estates against the crown is no longer defended, but rather a new federalistic democratic idea of the state is propagated. This double covenant idea advances the discussion by asking the key questions of the obligations that the ruler has incumbent upon him. George Buchanan then followed with what has been called the most influential political essay of the century with his The Rights of the Crown of Scotland. This early Protestant asserted as follows in reference to a king or an elected official: it was much safer to trust liberties to laws than to kings. Confine them to the narrow bounds and thrust them into the cells of law, circumscribe them in a close prison. The rulers were to be subordinate to a constitution, as is seen in Buchanan's statement. Kings, being accordingly left in other respects free, found their power confined to prescribe limits only by the necessity of squaring their words and actions by directions of law. Buchanan called it an egregious mistake to suppose that nations created kings not for the maintenance of justice, but for the enjoyment of pleasure. And he maintained that the people for whom the king derived his power should have the liberty of prescribing its bounds. and I require that he should exercise over the people only those rights which he has received from their hands. Buchanan noted, the law then is paramount to the king and serves to direct and moderate his passions and actions. Many people think of Johannes Althusius as the pinnacle of Reformation political thought. I won't comment on his works other than to say how grateful I am and other scholars are to note that the Liberty Press has republished his work, and I will simply refer that to you in the interest of time. This pinnacle of Reformation political theology made it very clear that government was limited, and indeed, if I had more time, could make a case that it is his words, or at least his concepts, that rest behind some of the specific amendments to our Constitution, chiefly among them the 10th Amendment to the Constitution that says, besides whatever power the people did not have, it could not transfer to its administrators. So maybe on another time we could explore that. And in the interest of time, I'm afraid I'll have to skip over Samuel Rutherford's work. Lex Rex was a potent political document of the time, well read, and people who founded the American colonies were very familiar with that. The thrust, if I could just have a one-sentence or so summary of Samuel Rutherford's work, was that the king or the elected ruler had executive power, hence the name of our executive branch of government. And while that is misunderstood today, earlier Reformation thought believed that the king or the monarch was appointed to be a servant or an executor, hence an executive. And a number of analogies are used. Civil governors were not so much dominating lords as they were compared to ministerial fiduciaries, tutors, husbands, patrons, ministers, or fathers. To be a king and an absolute master, said Rutherford, are contradictory. Well, let me move to the final turning point, and that was the Federalist impulse in the U.S. Constitution. These Puritan theologies led to the colonization of the New World. And the Puritans loom very large in our own intellectual history as cultivating some of the strongest democracies. All sides, whether sympathetic to the Puritans or not, admit that the Puritan faith was the foundation of the New World colonies. And it's very important to note that the features such as limited terms, balance of powers, ideas like citizen nullification, interpositional magistracies, and the accountability to the church authorities were at the heart of these Puritan documents. From my study, I conclude that over a century prior to our United States nation's formation, a century prior to the Revolution, most of these major ideas were set, and they were originated not properly from social contract theory so much as from the strand of thought stemming from Beza and Buchanan and Rutherford with their distinctly Old Testament and biblical moorings. Barry Allen Shane has done a wonderful job recently in determining that rather than a generic republicanism or a 17th century libertarianism nourishing the root of the American democracy, a much older religion did, indeed, the biblical faith. And Americans at the time of our revolution did not hold to a republican outlook per se so much, at least not one that was anthropocentric and independent of a Christian faith in an omniscient God, but rather his research finds that they were a parochial reformed Protestant people whose thought was strikingly dependent upon the Christian origin or natural ordering of the cosmos. Indeed, Shane and others point out that the very term republican in and about the time of 1776 was a defamatory cliche many times associated with atheism and radicalism. It was only after the revolution in our country that that became such a prominent and a positive term. The Federalist impulse, a contribution that is often minimized in an anarchical zeitgeist, flowed directly from this Judeo-Christian seedbed. Perhaps James Madison, who had been educated under the paradigm of John Knox in the early days of Princeton, reflected this view when he said these words, "Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government but the greatest of all reflections of human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary." A theological belief, the doctrine of human depravity, animated his politics. In closing, this resilient strain of thought is seen in its continuations among the Dutchmen, Guillaume Grin van Prinsterer and Abraham Kuyper. But before I close with a quote from Kuyper, I want to also acquaint you with a modern liberal German theologian, Jürgen Moltmann, who I rarely quote from, but he wrote a very brilliant article in 1992 entitled Covenant or Leviathan. And in this he contrasts in modern Europe the idea that the loss of the reformational paradigm of covenant led, in his view, to the Nazi Leviathan. The separation of religion from politics, far from being salutary, relinquished politics to unscrupulous and unrestrained forces. Once freed from a transcendent ethic, the state became monopolistic, then totalitarian. Unleashed from the social covenant introduced by these Reformation thinkers, peace and freedom were kidnapped by tyranny. Abraham Kuyper, in the quote that I have for you in the handout, summarizes the political faith of Calvinism in these three propositions. First of all, that God only is possessed of sovereign rights as creator, and no human ruler can usurp or assume those improperly. Secondly, sin and the doctrine of depravity necessitates a human government. And thirdly, that no human being may ever possess power over his fellow man in any other way than in the way that God himself ordains. Calvinism protests against state omnicompetence, against the horrible conception that no right exists above and beyond existing laws, and against the pride of absolutism, which does not recognize constitutional rights. Earlier this year, the USA Today Weekend Edition posed a question. I'll close with this. Who is the man of the millennium? Their answer was Thomas Jefferson. It may be closer to true if we can but leave the immediacy of our own single day with its own peculiar myopia. Say 1,000 years hence to the year 2997, that to the surprise of many of our contemporaries, the man who contributed the most to the second millennium AD may prove to be a religious leader, Martin Luther, John Calvin, George Buchanan, or Samuel Rutherford, more in keeping with the irony that often intrudes itself, and also in the spirit of a superb, essential but little known offensive lineman, it may prove to be the anonymous author of the Vindicia Contra Tyrannis. His thought, after all, has felled many a totalitarian tyrant and may even be in the process of tumbling some of the remaining tyrants in the West. His thought, at least, gets my vote, and I hope Dr. Novak will consider adding Geneva then to the list of his 6 cities, completing the typology with the biblical number 7. Thank you.